Okay, let's get this week over with. I'm John Arola. Brett's here.
Also nice to be here. I value every moment I get to spend with John, but apparently he could take it or leave it.
No, you being here is one of the best things about here right now.
Thanks.
But yeah, no, it's been a terrible week.
You fish hard enough for a compliment, you'll get it.
Yeah, that's enough though. And so you're here, and you've got an episode of Happy Half Hour coming out.
Happy Half Hour today at 5 p.m. Pacific time on our, you know, all the places where you get it. We have Justin Walter, who is a travel host, and he's gonna go through the UpRocks hot list that he contributed to.
What's the list?
It's the hot list of the places to go in 2020, if you wanna just get the hell away. And it's all over, it's all over America, so like lesser known, more accessible cities. Like he covers Carson City, Nevada. He's like, people go to Vegas, but did you know you could go to Carson City and have the best time and just go to like a dive bar downtown and have like the best night of your life?
That sounds cool.
So we do that and we drink, we must have had about 15 Dr. Peppers. Because he also goes to Texas where those were born.
And you, was it really? Yeah. And did you also delve into the world of goop, correct?
Goop, yeah, we get real, really nasty and sticky and goop.
Somebody had to.
Anyway, energy heal.
You know, I wish I'd been on that show too. Just all three of us drinking Dr. Pepper sounds great. But anyway, we're not gonna do that. We're gonna drink coffee because we desperately need it. It's early. And we're gonna go through some important news. We're gonna have some corruption news for you in just a little bit. But later on, Tom Steyer, like noted nice guy in politics, takes a turn towards the negative.
Bless him.
Pete Buttigieg receives a rousing response to one of his quotes at the town hall. But was it what it appeared to be? And we're gonna close out the week as we have the past few weeks by choosing our garbage people of the week, which is a highlight for me. So that should be a lot of fun. Okay, now with that said, why don't we jump right into it? More corruption news involving Donald Trump, both on the what we have learned side, but also the what are we not going to learn side. So let's start off with what we've learned. And so we know that Donald Trump likes to visit his own properties, and when he does that, he has to take, you know, all of the apparatus of state that are necessary for him to do his job, Secret Service protection, all of that. And that they have to pay wherever they stay. And if they're staying at a place that he owns, they are paying him with my money and your money and your money. But we're still waiting to learn a lot about how much. We know that he's visited his own properties on 342 days in just a few years. So a significant percentage of all the days. And so
I haven't been to my own house that much.
Like maybe, I don't know. I come here about that often. So there have been a lot of requests for information. We want a full accounting of how much is actually being spent, where the money is going, what's it for, all that. And we don't have that full accounting, but we do have recently, there was this last November, there was a public records request, and the Secret Service released 56 payments that have been made to Trump companies, all from 2017. So anything more recent than that, they did not divulge. And in the accounting that they gave, there was very little information about what it was for. In many cases, they wouldn't even reveal for an individual payment what state the property was in, let alone which property it actually was. Reporters had to do calculations of sales tax to try to find out, because some states have very specific sales taxes, like New Jersey's like 6.8755 or something like that. They were able to track down some of them in that way, but let's go over what we do actually know. So at least 20 of the payments to Trump National Golf Club worth $63,700 weren't to a golf club. Other documents showed they were payments to Mar-a-Lago. The Post learned that many of them were hotel bills for $650 per night, a rate far higher than the usual limits on federal hotel spending. There's no legal limit on what the Secret Service can spend on hotel rooms while its agents are protecting the president. So honestly, just bring as many as you can, because you can pay more for them than you can for regular federal employees. But this is what was given after requests for documentation. Documentation that's supposed to be public, these sorts of expenses, you're supposed to be able to get them. That's what people like Ken Klippenstein live for. And yet even then, we only got a very limited range of numbers, all from 2017, with as little information as possible.
Yes, it is, for me it's like anti-conservative even. Like there, and when I say that, I mean like there are things that people do that they don't have to necessarily do. There's no like law written down explicitly. And that is like, man, you should probably divest from all the stuff that you could potentially profit on in the future. And everyone, every politician that you've thought was like a slimy swamp creature has done that. Mm-hmm. Every single politician that you revile for being a corrupt leech off of the federal teat is, those are two different fluids they drink. Anyways, but like, they have been decent enough to divest themselves and alleviate any or get rid of any possibility that they could be perceived to be corrupt mm-hmm. in this specific way. Trump hasn't done that.
Yeah.
And what's worse, he also in all a lot of these examples, he incentivizes people to do the kinds of things that the actual laws, like the emoluments clause of the Constitution, are written explicitly. So the implied thing he still does,
yeah.
but the explicit thing that is being proven, and his properties are actually jacking up prices to stay there
yeah.
around events that are explicitly political, like the Republican National Convention spring meeting or whatever it's called. He's jacking up the prices and people are like, we gotta do it at his club so that we can curry favor. And then you look yesterday at his like weird victory lap of acquittal when it really was literally, you know, Mitch, it isn't acquittal if you see that on the lower thirds of all those like CNN mm-hmm. news programs. It's Mitch McConnell got Trump off.
Yeah.
He got him off, period. That's all it is. And that's how disgusting and just pornographic it is. He's just like, they're just getting him off. But yeah.
What is going on right now?
I'm just saying, like,
on the Daniels Report.
Because I don't know how else to do it about this is over the top, wanton, and explicit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the discourse in America reflects that enough.
Yeah.
I hear, oh, what a booming economy we have with a jobs report. Even though the stock market went down today.
Yeah.
In the wake of it. So even the thing that is a gross misrepresentation of the actual health of the economy that reflects on people's like actual kitchen tables, the rhetoric and the discourse and the messaging doesn't reflect how disgusting things are right now.
Yeah.
So Mitch McConnell got him off and the like.
Yeah. Yeah, it's and there's so much there. I mean, the violations of the Emoluments Clause and other related regulations, norms, and traditions we have around your ability to immediately personally profit off of your political position. Like there were a lot of people during the impeachment process that were like, is this really what we should be focusing on? Maybe not. Then go look into this stuff. A lot of these people are literally reporters who have no interest in investigating the other more obvious corrupt economic crimes that he commits. But anyway, on this, I have to assume that if you were to sit down with a series of Trump supporters who would definitely not be bothered by this, they believe, he's taking my money, he's literally profiting off of it, but he's a good person, he deserves to. That is, again, not an actual position they are expressing. If it were any other politician, they would not be okay with this. If President Al Gore had a bed and breakfast that he was like keeping CIA agents at, they wouldn't have been okay with it.
They say that he profits off the green tickets or the carbon credits. They say they do that.
Yeah.
They criticize Al Gore for helping to invent a currency that checks carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And every conservative I've ever spoken to says, in addition to like, but he flies a plane,
mm-hmm.
comes back with, oh no, he's just doing that to create his own little economy. And my counter argument to them is, well, I point out the hypocrisy that you pointed out, but also like, isn't that what a conservative would do?
Yeah.
Wouldn't they find a way to, I mean, your argument is that if you create the right financial incentives, you can make money and improve the world at the same time.
Yeah.
Isn't that what Al Gore did? But you don't even have to make up a fictional situation for them to show their hypocrisy. They did that exact thing with Al Gore.
Yeah, and they will rightfully in the future. I look forward to some of these people, the right-wing pundits and the politicians who have no problem with Trump doing this, earning literally millions. In the future, if some Democrat does it, thankfully they will then, because of tribalism, they will be on the right side again in attacking it if it happens. And I worry that it will, because after the experience of the past few years, what politician would ever be idiot enough to divest from an industry that they could personally, why would you do that?
Yeah.
When Trump has gotten away with corruption on a scale we haven't seen in 100 years or longer.
Yeah.
I don't understand. Now, really fast, I just want to mention, in terms of our ability to investigate these sorts of things through discovery and in court cases, things like that, As of a new ruling, individual members of Congress cannot sue President Trump to stop his private businesses from accepting payments from foreign governments. That's according to a federal appeals court earlier today. An unsigned order from the judges say the members can and likely will continue to use their weighty voices to make their case to the American people, their colleagues in the Congress, and the president himself, all of whom are free to engage in that argument as they see fit. But we will not, indeed we cannot, participate in this debate. So if you believe that in the most obvious textbook case, he's violating the Emoluments Clause, yeah, go take it up on a podium or something. We're not allowing you to sue the president for clearly breaking the law, breaking the Constitution.
And when Trump is defending himself, there is no consistent legal argument. When it comes to the subpoenas, in one, in one forum, when he was getting impeached, he said you should subpoena it through the court. When you subpoena it through the court, he's like, you got to impeach him. That's the only way. Yeah. So it is not a consistent. It is always hypocrisy from the president because it's not about what's right. It's not about the rule of law. It's about letting him get away with stuff. And yeah, we can't let that happen.
Agreed. Okay, stick around. Lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Industrial espionage from China is something that's popped up over the years in both news accounts, but also media. The idea that secrets and technology, sometimes from the military, are being secreted away. But what's the reality? What has actually been going on over the past few decades? What does it look like now? We're joined by journalist and author of The Scientist and the Spy, Mara Vistendahl. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me on the show again.
Very glad to have you here. So the topic is obviously very dramatic, but you have an account of real people, real instances going back literally decades. Give us an idea of what the reality is like.
Sure. My book starts with a man named Robert Moe, who was found in a field in Iowa in 2011. This was a Monsanto cornfield that the company protected as trade secrets. They were growing genetically modified inbred corn there. And his appearance in that field set off a two-year FBI investigation that involved car chases, surveillance planes overhead, flying overhead, and even the use of a FISA warrant, which is typically reserved for extreme national security threats. So the US government treated this as a major threat, and I set out to find out why.
So, I mean, I guess the immediate follow-up question is, why is it being treated in that fashion? The intellectual seed property that we're talking about here, how significant is that in terms of like the national security of the United States, even its economic sort of import?
Well, over the past few decades, we've seen this shift from the US government treating things like terrorism and so forth as national security to including trade secret theft and industrial espionage in the list of extreme national security threats. There have been dozens of cases involving China brought in the last few years. The FBI Director Christopher Wray recently said that there are over 1,000 active cases. And I was living as a reporter in China when I first heard about Robert Moe's case. I reported on science and research, and then suddenly my beat was in the international news and had become this major focus for the US government. The argument is that people like him are targeting the US innovation in infrastructure, that they are taking money away from average Americans, and that that justifies the US government going after these perpetrators. But what I found is that the story is actually a lot more complicated.
Okay, well, I mean, clearly I want to follow up on that, but I'm curious, you talk about 1,000 current cases. This is obviously something that they're focusing on far more in recent years. Is it something that they've gotten a handle on? Is China changing its practices? Is this as common as it once was?
Well, certainly there is a lot of industrial espionage happening from China. There is a major emphasis on technology from the Chinese government. And so far, this FBI effort has not stopped that drain. The question I wanted to ask in the book is, what is the collateral damage of our focus on these cases? You know, are there people who are getting hurt? And is this use of resources, as happened in the Robert Moe case, is that a good use? Is that a where American taxpayers' dollars should be spent?
You know, and I'm curious because obviously there are a lot of countries that we work with on projects that we sell military technology to that theoretically could be reverse engineered. And you write in your book, I'm curious about China as opposed to some of these other cases. You write in the book that much of US counter-intel policies were tinged with racism. So through your analysis, how important was racism in our reaction to countries like China versus other countries that might also be engaging in industrial espionage?
Well, so when I set out to tell this story of Robert Moe, you know, I reported it from all sides. I really retraced his steps, and it's just an extremely colorful story. Tried to tell it scene by scene, almost like a thriller, so that readers would get kind of a dose of geopolitics in a really, hopefully, riveting book. But along the way, people told me I should go back and look at the history of how the FBI has treated Chinese American scientists. People started coming to me with stories of their family members who had been surveilled or hounded in some cases through the 1960s up to the 1980s. Using a Freedom of Information Act request, I discovered that this was actually a dedicated program to surveil Chinese American scientists, including US citizens.
And is there any indication that something like that might be continuing to the present day?
There are a number of community groups and Congress people who are certainly concerned that it is continuing. There have been cases in just the past few years where scientists were charged with a very serious crime, and then charges were entirely dropped because it turned out that they were innocent and the FBI had gotten the science wrong. So these are incredibly complex cases. They require the FBI to understand China, understand technology, and understand intellectual property law, which are very complicated things.
And look, I understand that the going into it, the goal was mainly about understanding this, presenting it, all of that. But based on your analysis, do you have any sort of suggestions for what could be done in the future to get us to a place where we're not just investigating and stopping the industrial espionage, but it isn't as big of a factor in the relationship between China and the US?
Mm-hmm. Well, when you look at protecting innovation, which is that what the US government says is the ultimate goal of these efforts, In something like the seed industry, corporate consolidation is actually a much bigger threat to to average Americans and to farmers. So companies like Monsanto have only gotten bigger over the past few years. And there's this irony in the book where by the end of my reporting, Monsanto had been acquired by Bayer and was no longer even American. So the U.S. government had spent massive amounts of money defending this company that was no longer on U.S. soil.
Interesting. Okay, so I can certainly see some implications going on from the future. Mara, I want to thank you for joining us on the show today. The book is The Scientist and the Spy, A True Story of China, the FBI, and Industrial Espionage. Thank you once again.
Well, thank you so much for having me again.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, lots more political news to get to. For some reason, Hillary Clinton is on tour through all of the American media, like Ellen, Howard Stern, she's all over the place. And whether she wants to or not, and she seems to want to, the topic inevitably ends up getting to the Democratic primary and she weighs in. And we're gonna have that in just a second, her thoughts about, not stated, but about people like Bernie Sanders. So first of all, in talking about the fact that Trump was acquitted, she had this to say. I say two things. I say vote for the person who you believe can actually win in November against him now that he's gonna be running, and the person who you think can govern our country. Because somebody has to get in there and try to bring our country together and put us on the right track into the future and restore our democracy and our standing in the world. I start with that to let you know that she doesn't exclusively come in guns blaring. But we're gonna have that for you in just a little second.
It's just so weird the position people contort themselves into. Mm-hmm. And this idea that, and it's so sad because there's things people believe that most Americans agree on. And for some reason, there's a mental block against voting for someone who also backs those things. Mm-hmm. And I understand it. I understand that mental block because 75% of Americans wanted witnesses in the impeachment trial. Mm-hmm. And only 47% of maybe 48% of the Senate voted that way.
Yeah.
So that's like our baseline for like trusting our own instincts. Mm-hmm. We can't. It's supposed to be a representative democracy, but there's so many steps in between democracy and our representatives that it ends up being this weird like kaleidoscope view of America. Mm-hmm. It's very strange, but for this, I get this is the setup. This mm-hmm. is the setup
it's
for
the
her.
Setup.
And I do think people like her have this weird other like malfunction in their brains where it's like they had a definition for electability going into 2016. That definition was proven utterly wrong, but for some reason they're not abandoning that definition.
They can't accept that. Yeah. Yeah, well actually we're going to have that in just a sec. So she went on to say, "Who do you think can win? Because if you don't win, you can't govern, obviously. Mm-hmm. And who can best govern at a very difficult time in American history?" Okay, that's
right.
Fine. She's an interesting person to be expressing that, but that's fine.
Right.
She says, "It seems to me more than ever that we need somebody who's going to go in." Oh, sorry, this is Ellen. This is Ellen. "It seems to me more than ever that we need somebody who's going to go in and be able to steer the ship in the right direction instead of going to the extreme." And I could be wrong, but I believe, look, I think Hillary would have eventually ended up sort of talking about Bernie, but I do also think that the people that bring her onto their show are like,
Yeah. They want to get her there.
Talk about Bernie. And she would have, and she wants to, and when you poke her, she will. But I think Ellen right there is trying to get her to slam certain candidates.
We're already pointed in an extreme direction. Mm-hmm. A turn toward the extreme opposite direction is still a turn in the direction a moderate person would go first.
You gotta pass moderate before you get to the other extreme.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and by the way, I know that they will never accept this, but Bernie Sanders actually does have a theory about how you bring people together. Like Trump says he does, but he doesn't. When he was asked today about how you unify the country, he said, you unify the way we have with our base, with success. But that's not unifying, that's just doubling down on your base. Bernie actually believes that we can cut across regular ideological and party lines by organizing around the actual interests of a large percentage of the American public who have been ignored for decades and decades by politicians.
Yeah, well, Trump's definition is wrong. Trump's definition should be, has been, I'm gonna get the economy going in this way. This mm-hmm. is my economy definition of success. And I will get reelected based on that, right?
Yeah.
But there's polling out, like I think this week saying that whereas in the past, if people said, yes, that definition of the economy, we are going in the right direction economically. In the past, something like 90% of people who answered, yes, the economy is going in the right way, voted for the incumbent. But right now, it's 50. 50%, 52, 54% of people who think the economy is going in the right way. And I think that's kind of warped by the way economic success has traditionally been defined in terms of like S&P 500.
Yeah.
But even that, like his rhetoric and people's exhaustion with it and his inability to really acknowledge that people also consider like how much healthcare costs to be in line with economic success, like, he has failed by his own definition of the economy.
Yeah, yeah, so that's I had not seen that stat. So now let's jump into the money stuff. So she was asked by Ellen about her comments from the documentary that came out a bit ago, slamming Bernie as nobody likes him, nobody wants to work with him. Yeah, nobody liked him right into the lead of the popular vote in Iowa. So she said, well, it's from the film, which was probably filmed about a year and a half ago or so. So it wasn't in the midst of an election. But at the same time, she doubled down by saying she has, quote, a clear perspective about what it's going to take to win. Well, I wish she'd had that earlier. And look, I know, look, I've pointed out a million times that she won the popular vote, and I think that that does matter. But it doesn't matter as much as winning matters because you didn't win and because you're not winning. Now, she goes on to say, people can have their own opinions about anybody in public life. That's a free country. You get to do that. You've got to be responsible for what you say and what you say you're going to do. And if you promise the moon and you can't deliver the moon, then that's going to be one more indicator of how we just can't trust each other. Presumably Bernie is promising a lunar voyage.
Right, she promised, so by her definition, she promised, I don't know, like a moon pie. And she couldn't even deliver that. Like, and that's the that's the thing that's very frustrating with Democratic Party moderates is that they go in with their second or third offer. And they think that it's the respectable thing to do. I think they're wrong about what Bernie's first offer and even Elizabeth Warren's like original position on healthcare is. That first offer is viable because people believe in it. People and the Democratic caucuses in Iowa believed in that kind of healthcare system. And somehow Hillary has convinced herself that it's a pie in the sky dream when it really isn't, because people support it. And that's what's frustrating is they think that if you come in with a strong position, negotiation wise, or just it's either Bernie has a strong negotiating position or he just actually is saying what he believes. I think both of those things are appealing, but for some reason to moderates like Hillary Clinton, that is somehow disingenuous and somehow like gonna bite you in the butt in the end after you win. But that would be after winning. That's a good problem to have because you've already won, as opposed to putting yourself, as Elizabeth Warren did, as she pivoted away from a strict Medicare for all, single payer, all the way system. You end up putting yourself in a weird position where you've already negotiated away the house.
Yeah. And then to make it basically the same as what Trump is doing, it's just another way that we can't trust each other. That's disingenuous. I will close by saying mainly the reason I want to talk about this, I'm not as into the just constantly dissecting what Hillary says for the sake of talking about Hillary as some people are. I know it's like crowd pleaser or whatever. I don't really care about it. Mainly because I don't think that it hurts Bernie at all. I think that Bernie raised $25 million in January. I think in large part due to the feud with Elizabeth Warren and the big attacks against him by Hillary Clinton. I think he was gonna raise a lot of money anyway, but those certainly, they just don't hurt. There is no evidence that Hillary Clinton slamming him or anyone affiliated with the Democratic establishment attacking him hurts him in any measurable way. And so for Hillary Clinton, like, either you're basically his secret ally at this point. Every time you pop up, he's gonna earn another $1 million to $3 million. It's just bizarre behavior to think that you have an effect that you don't. Like, she clearly doesn't want him to be president, but everything she does increases the odds that he's going to be. So that's bizarre.
Yeah, and we're in a realignment. We're in a realignment, and they're acting as though we're not. And that's why she lost.
Yeah.
That, and she's not a good candidate on a stage.
Yeah.
And you can make up for one with the other, but she had neither.
Yeah, she had both working against her. Okay, we're gonna take a break. Lots more after this. We'll be right back. throughout this Democratic primary, Tom Steyer has sort of been like the nice guy. Like when he's, you know, walking up after a debate to try to shake Bernie's hand and Bernie doesn't want anything to do with him, or like no one on stage is more likely to say that they agree with someone else than Tom Steyer. He's been so positive. We've got a new ad where he takes a turn towards the negative. Take a look.
4 years ago, Donald Trump beat the Democratic establishment. And then he outlasted Democratic insiders in Washington on impeachment, despite his obvious crimes and corruption.
The president is guilty.
Now, if we don't do something different this time around, he'll win again. That's the hard truth. We simply can't afford to nominate another insider or an untested newcomer who doesn't have the experience to beat Trump on the economy. We need to think different. Tom Steyer is a progressive businessman who left his company and is using his time and money to beat big corporations and address climate change. He can expose Donald Trump as a fraud and failure on the economy.
He's running on the economy. He's running on the idea that Democrats can't grow an economy, are a bunch of socialists you can't afford to vote for. My job is to take on Mr. Trump and kick his ass on the economy.
I'm Tom Steyer, and I approve this message.
Okay, so there was, you had Biden, Buttigieg, a reference to socialists. I can't say for sure that he's never run an ad directly attacking any of his rivals. This is the first that I've seen, though. And he's putting $8 million of airtime for that ad. Over $5 million in California alone for that particular ad. Big spends in some of the other upcoming states, too. More than $1 million in New Hampshire over just the next couple of days. What do you think about this?
I think that the problem Tom Steyer was facing, well, he has a lot of problems. He's facing a lot of challenges to overcome, but one of them he's facing is that someone asked me, like, someone said, I like Tom Steyer. And my response was, like, I like Tom Steyer too. I also like Labradors. You know, like, he's Mr. Peanut Butter. He's like, hi.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, there's something kind of irksome about him.
He's 10% cartoon character.
But he also seems like kind of a positive, upbeat dude. That moment when he was between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, you're just like, oh, I really like this. I like him as a person.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I've been in that position.
But he is a billionaire who worked through, he earned a lot of money over the course of his life. And I don't think that that really has been communicated through. And now he sees Bloomberg in his rearview mirror. And he did see Bloomberg in his rearview mirror. And he watched Bloomberg fly right by him. Mm-hmm. And Steyer's like, wait a minute, I'm a successful businessman too. Have I been communicating that effectively?
Yeah.
Previously,
it really hasn't.
It was him in like Patagonia fleeces being like, hey, this is my family and we did a good job taking money back from billionaires after I made all that money.
Yeah.
But he's seeing really effective advertisement from Bloomberg and I think he's trying to get back into it.
Yeah, yeah. Although the advertisement from Bloomberg is about ice cream and dogs, and now there's gingerbread.
No, it's not, John.
I know what you're saying. There's actual ads on Facebook. Jesus.
I am not a Bloomberg supporter, but John doesn't understand because he doesn't like me watch Jeopardy all the time.
Bloomberg has been running.
Yeah.
Oh, don't say it.
He's been running effective advertising during football games and Jeopardy.
Look,
and cable news.
You say so I don't acknowledge that. I do acknowledge that. I keep coming on the show and saying people who are writing off Bloomberg as not having a chance of winning just because it's Bloomberg. No, he's spending $1 billion and it's going to all the right places. He's putting ads in front of Jeopardy, but also Pokemon on YouTube. And he's all over Facebook and he spent $1 billion in California.
And to bring it back to here, someone who definitely notices that is Tom Steyer.
Agreed. Yeah, Tom Steyer, like, he seems like a nice guy, but I don't see any path whatsoever.
Me neither.
Put your money into something more productive. You seem so nice. Come on our show. I'll give you some ideas.
For the next 15
minutes. Give it to the Sunrise Movement. Just give every dollar that you would have spent on this to the Sunrise Movement. I guarantee it'll be better spent.
Yeah, that's what's frustrating. But yeah, to see them spend all this money on themselves. It's you know, there's a message in that says I will help people, but there are other ways for billionaires to help people. And they are less selfish than trying to get elected president.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
What do you think about it?
I mean, I think I don't know how much of the appeal that he does have, which again is in a couple of states he's at like 7%. Like I don't want in Nevada and South Carolina, he's actually polling okay. I don't know how much of that is riding on the perception that he's a nice guy. So turning negative, I can't say for sure yet how damaging that could potentially be. Like if Bernie suddenly was vicious, that would seem weird because he doesn't generally do that.
But that wasn't a negative ad to me.
Okay.
It wasn't.
It won't be read as vicious.
Pete Buttigieg molests collies. I don't know. That's from.
Into dogs today.
I guess that's why. That's a Caddyshack reference. Don't think I'm a weirdo who just pulls that out of nowhere.
Yeah, but it did occur to you.
Yeah.
Okay, we have one other thing I want to get to though in this block that might even be a little bit weirder. So let's turn now to Pete Buttigieg. Pete Buttigieg was one of many candidates, although not all, who was given a CNN town hall recently. And in it, he had a little line that apparently he liked because his campaign clipped it out for social media. But there was a subtle difference once it hit social media. So CPD Action has a little mashup showing the two. See if you can catch what's different.
And statistically, we run the risk of being the first generation in American history to actually be worse off economically than our parents if nothing is done to change the trajectory of this economy. To me, that is not just a concern for our generation. It's a concern that calls on us to build an alliance among generations to try to make sure that the future really is better than the past. And you don't get that by promising to turn back the clock. You get that by finding ways to make change work for us before we're all disrupted out of a good livelihood by it.
Let me introduce you to Tyler Lentz, who recently graduated from business school. He works for a community bank in the Austin suburbs. Tyler?
Did you catch that? It was subtle. So they added a ton of applause. Not just applause, like raucous applause. And look, in the full clip, when he finally ends, there is applause, but it's not even like they move that applause up. That applause that he got was, hey, I like that line. That's good. You acknowledge. The one in the ad was, woo!
As an editor of like internet videos, the search terms you put in to get that advertisement, that sound effect are like raucous applause arena.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
that
yeah.
kind of stuff. Many people, 75% female. Like they're very specific. And there's someone at the Buttigieg campaign who hears a lot of guys, you know, one version of guys going, oh! And then, woo! And then kids, hooray! And then that one. And they're like, that's the one I'm going to put on to just, you know, to trick the American people into thinking that was a giant applause line.
Yeah, so look, it's obviously embarrassing, especially coming just a couple of weeks after this.
It is an expression of hope that we can actually make our own lives better by having better hands guided by better values on those pulleys and levers of American government. So can I look to you to spread that sense of hope to those that you know? Come on.
That was
okay.
That was
definitely Krusty. And I don't know. Did someone add that? Now I don't know what to believe.
I know what to believe. That was Krusty the Clown.
Yes. And look, people have weird. I have a weird laugh,
yes.
And it's the same as my dad's. So I will literally punch you in the face if you ever mock it. But I acknowledge you can have a weird laugh. It's totally cool. But anyway, it's fake. On a scale of 1 to 10 outrages, how many outrages should we have?
1.5. I'm not that outraged by this.
Okay. But I think the reason that this has spread like wildfire through Twitter is there's been a lot of fake stuff from Buttigieg, like the fake supporters for his civil rights plan.
Yes.
Like that sort of like there's a perception of inauthenticity, and it's not like Buttigieg wasn't on Adobe Premiere adding laughs. Totally get that. But with that and the dance and like there's a perception that he's not being honest. These are own goals that are not necessary from his campaign.
Right. It is proven. Like the reason people look to a young, what are you laughing at? people look to his argument for himself is that people are looking to a fresh face to look forward. Mm-hmm. And the benefit of a new face is typically you can't go too deep into their, the skeletons that they've been hiding from people based on things they did back in the day. But in this one national campaign that he is running, he has shifted pretty substantially on the ideological curve or whatever it is, specifically as it comes to healthcare. So he doesn't even get the benefit of that. He is submarined. Someone who's that smart, he's a very, very smart person, was not smart enough looking out over the candidacies and to pick a lane and stick to it. He is smart enough to adjust, but in doing so, he mortgages any credibility he has in terms of being a consistent figure in what, 5-6 months?
Yeah, I agree. So. Okay, we're gonna take one last break. We come back, the garbage people of the week. Close out the week. It's the end of the week and it's time to take out the trash. Here's this week's garbage people. That makes me so happy. Brett Ehrlich is here and we've each chosen a person who perfectly exemplifies living that garbage life. I'm gonna go first this week.
We love
it. It was tough. Like you said, it was tough during the break.
Yeah, it was a rough
one. It was a little bit tougher and there were definitely a few people that I thought of, one candidate in the Democratic primary in particular. But I ended up going with what I think is a little bit more substantive. It is Susan Collins.
I almost picked Susan. You know, there was a printout in the printer ready of Susan Collins, but I'm glad I didn't.
So this is Susan Collins. If you don't know, she was one of the many Republicans that voted not to convict Donald Trump. But only basically her and Lisa Murkowski sort of came out and really talked about it in a way that really frustrated me. And Susan Collins was the worst because she tried to defend herself as someone who doesn't need to remove him because he has learned his lesson, which is the stupidest thing I've heard in a very long time. But stupid in a way that matters. Like she is voting to continue the Trump presidency while also trying to cloak herself in supposedly being reasonable and rational and moderate. No one less earned the reputation that they continue to try to craft for themselves.
Yeah, there's no reason for that anymore. We're just reading receipts.
That's like all it
she
is.
She has never voted in the way that she gets credit for being.
Exactly, exactly. And so for that reason, she is the first of this week's garbage people.
Do you know who Rolo Tomasi is?
I don't.
Rolo Tomasi in LA Confidential is the fictional character created by Edmund Exley of the person who killed his father. He's just like this thing that you come up with. It's like a fake person, but you need to give it a name.
Okay.
And that is today's garbage person. It is Tank Fletherly, the CEO. Tank Fletherly is the person I've made up who is the CEO of Shadow.
Okay.
Which is the company that made the Iowa app. I'm sure his name is Tank Fletherly, and I'm sure he rides on a bird scooter, and I'm sure that he lies to people all the time. Tank Fletherly tells people he's 27 years old and a tech entrepreneur when really his dad just gave him $14 million and he knows a coder. Tank Fletherly says he's 27. He's 54.
He looks good for 54.
And he looks great because he Gavin Belsons his way into platelet transmission so that he can.
From interns.
From
unpaid.
Interns. All that doesn't pay anybody. But he hangs out with Robbie Mook. Really wishing he was in, and like sometimes says hi to the crooked media guys. Like they all go to Martha's Vineyard and they have a great time and they have a technological solution to actual problems. Mm-hmm. This is the guy that's getting, you don't want me to say it, but like this is the tech entrepreneur that funds all kinds of campaigns promising some kind, they throw $1 billion at different campaigns that they're trying to say that they're a progressive, but they're actually not. They're just trying to get that government contract. They're in LA's DA race. They're pieces of garbage. They're funding Gascon. Don't vote for him. He tricked. These are the guys that trick a John Legend into endorsing them.
How Tank did you Fletherly. Make this about that race?
Because that's what happens. That's what's happening. There's okay, so many people.
Tank him. You gotta throw him away at some point.
Tank Fletherly.
The first fictional garbage person.
Tank Fletherly and Sons.
Oh my God.
Garbage person.
Okay, good pick. Interesting, yeah, to say the least.
Doesn't play lacrosse, but walks around with a lacrosse stick.
Okay, we gotta run. Thank you as always, Brett. Thank you, everybody who's been watching throughout the week. Next week is New Hampshire. Hope it goes better than Iowa. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.